You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 5th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building. What? In the fashionable Dahl Lunch District of New York City. Still rusty from my day off yesterday. Happy belated July 4th to you. Today on the program, Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone on the LIBOR scandal. Huge. Also today, the so-called God particle. Apparently scientists don't like to use that word. Higgs boson. Was found. May have been found. A Higgs was found. Maybe a boson was found. I don't really understand what it is. I will try and work it out with all of you. Also, on the program today, Wall Street Journal, have they now basically said that Romney's going to lose? Well, I think it sounds like it. 16 states now claiming they will not take the expansion of Medicaid from the federal government. And good news on voting purges. Republicans not as effective at doing that as one might have hoped if one was a Republican. All right, before we go to Matt Taibbi, saw this on Tiny Revolution, blog by Jonathan Schwartz. A quote apropos of July 4th, but also something to keep in mind. A quote by John Adams. Yes, that John Adams. The old, old guy who would be dead, or is dead, I should say. He would be really old if he was still alive. In a correspondence between John Adams and James Sullivan. James Sullivan was basically a state legislator from Massachusetts. Adams at that time was in the Second Continental Congress back in 1776. And John Adams wasn't terribly thrilled about a lot of people voting. However, he did have this to say in the context of who would get the right to vote. Power always follows property. He's talking about land, but he's really talking at that time, but he's really talking about assets. This I believed to be as infallible a maxim in politics as that action and reaction are equal in its mechanics. Nay, I believe we may advance one step further and affirm that the balance of power in a society accompanies the balance of property in land. The only possible way, then, of preserving the balance of power on the side of equal liberty and public virtue is to make the acquisition of land easy to every member of society, to make a division of the land into small quantities so that the multitude may be possessed of landed estates. If the multitude is possessed of the balance of real estate, the multitude will have the balance of power, and in that case, the multitude will take care of the liberty, virtue, and interest of the multitude in all acts of government. In other words, when you concentrate land or assets or money or capital in the hands of few, you have less liberty, virtue, and interest of the multitude in all acts of government. Man, who knew John Adams would have a problem with what's going on today? All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Taibbi. We are back on the phone. Pleasure to welcome back to the program from Rolling Stone magazine, Matt Taibbi. Matt, welcome to the program.
How's it going, Sam?
It's going pretty good. You know, I have been saying for, I guess, a week now at the beginning of the show that there's this big LIBOR scandal and can't get to it today. Don't know what it means.
Right.
Don't know what it means. Don't know the implications. We'll have to get to it to tomorrow. And tomorrow has finally come, and we have got the one person, as far as I can tell, has been covering it in outside of sort of narrow financial circles. Tell us what.
Right.
Tell us what the LIBOR is.
LIBOR is the London Interbank Exchange Rate. It's basically the rate at which banks borrow from each other, and it's in everything. Basically, every variable rate investment in the world is pegged to LIBOR. So if you have a credit card that where the rate floats or it changes, if you look at the contract, it'll say something like LIBOR plus 8% or LIBOR plus 9%. What that basically means is that they're using this rate that the banks established to borrow from each other as the benchmark for everything. So what's been going on is the banks have been gaming LIBOR, which is in like about $800 trillion worth of financial products worldwide, to make themselves more money. It couldn't possibly be a bigger, huger financial scandal.
So this is, and I think at one point you wrote that a buddy of yours who works on Wall Street said, it's like finding out that the whole world is on quicksand.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because again, LIBOR is in everything. So mortgages, you know, all those people who had adjustable rate mortgages, remember that craze,
uh-huh.
You know, from
I know something big happened there.
So all those adjustable rate mortgages, almost all of them are LIBOR based. So, you know, it'd be, LIBOR plus 5.5 or whatever it is. So if you play around with LIBOR and LIBOR is either up or down, you know, a fraction of a percent off what it should be, then it's going to, you know, everybody who has a mortgage or has a credit card is going to pay less, and everybody who has a LIBOR bearing investment or an investment that's based on LIBOR is going to earn less. So it basically affects everybody who has any kind of investment or loan in the world.
Now, my understanding is that there were essentially two different sort of types of manipulation that was going on here with Barclays, and because this is the first that we've, or at least this is the only, I guess, known instance that we that has come to light of manipulating this, right? So,
right. Yeah.
Although there's some indication, but we'll get to that in a minute. But talk mm-hmm. about the first manipulation, when it was reported, and what it is.
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly when the first one was, because now we're getting reports that this goes back as far as the year 2000, but the one that they're hanging their hat on.
All right, the one so, I mean, this is getting larger as we speak, I guess.
Right, yeah, exactly.
But tell us of the initial reports in terms of Barclays.
Right.
We heard something about, I guess, 2005, 2006, 2007.
There's two, let's just say, speaking more general terms, there's two different types of manipulation that we're talking about. What one is where, again, just to back up for a second, what is LIBOR? Every morning, this British Bankers Association calls up 16 of the biggest banks in the world, and they ask, how much does it cost you to borrow from other banks today, right? And when that number is low, when the interest rate they're charging each other is low, that means the banks are basically healthy, that they trust each other. When the number's high, it's an indication of instability. So what happened in 2008 during the crisis was that the banks were faking the numbers to make themselves look more stable so that they could produce a sort of general appearance of stability in the market. So that's one sort of general form of manipulation. The more specific form, which is, I think, is what you're talking about with the 2005 right. and 2006, comes when some trader who works at a company like Barclays calls up the LIBOR manipulator, and he basically says, hey, if you shove it down a few notches today, we're going to make more money on X, Y, or Z holdings that we have, or it's going to cost us X amount less to borrow or to buy treasuries or whatever it is, and so that we have all these instances in the settlements we see of traders calling up these guys and basically just asking them to bump the level down a little bit. So that's like more for personal for the individual gain of the bank, whereas the other form is to sort of produce a general appearance of health.
And they're able to manipulate this because they're really talking about what they project they're going to be able to borrow money at. And I guess it goes across something like they get 150 type of rates on all different instruments and all different time frames.
Right. Yeah, I have to confess I don't exactly understand how they make this projection, because there's some speculation that there might be two different places in the bank that this manipulation might be happening. It might be happening at the level of the guy who talks to the British Bankers Association, and then it also might be happening at the level of the people in the bank who talk to the LIBOR reporter, who are reporting all the numbers from those 150 different places within the bank. But I don't know how that calculation is made. All I know is that they end up, you know, giving a number every morning to this committee, and it's based on a projection of how much they think it's going to cost for them to borrow.
And and one aspect of this, the one where these banks are just trying to make money off of basically the difference in the spread or driving up the interest rates in some way for that they know will directly benefit them, because they hold instruments which will benefit from the idea that the rates are going up.
Right.
The second part, like you say, is or I guess you talked about it first, was the sort of faking the rates to make the banks look like they were more sound. And apparently Bob Diamond, who was the head of Barclays, who's since resigned, claims, or at least there's internal evidence at least, that he was basically pushed to doing this in some way. By the
Bank of England.
Bank of England. So, I mean, tell us what the implications of that are.
Yeah. So in late October of 2008, apparently Bob Diamond gets a call from Paul Tucker, who's the deputy governor of the Bank of England, and Tucker kind of obliquely says, "Hey, you know, we've been noticing that your LIBOR numbers are a little bit higher than all the other banks. What's the deal there?" And Diamond basically, according to him, Diamond says, "Well, the thing is, we're reporting the real numbers, and all the other banks are lying." And according to Diamond, Tucker then says, "Well, you know, your numbers don't always have to be so high." And he says this because he claims that he's been getting calls from Whitehall, from the British government, complaining about this. So the implications of this are that the British government is telling the biggest British bank to fake its LIBOR numbers. Now, there have been whispers that this has been going on not just in England but in America for a couple – actually, dating back to 2008, there's been speculation about this. But this is the first time that we've heard this, and if that's true, it's just it's an unbelievable thing. I mean, it's just I couldn't imagine anything more crazy than that.
And there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal back in 2008. I guess it was in May of 2008, saying that the Wall Street Journal saw that they are. That some banks are reporting lower rates, costs to LIBOR, and it seems weird. Essentially, is what we're seeing.
Yeah, you could have deduced it from that there was a problem from some other data out there in the marketplace.
And so the implication is that these banks were encouraged by somebody, or at least somebody sort of. Didn't really follow up on this to pretend that they're more sound.
Right. And again, just to back up, the reason that these stories came out in 2008 and 2009 is because the numbers, the LIBOR numbers, didn't match the credit default spreads for these banks. So in other words, there's a the banks also buy credit default swaps against each other. This is complicated, but it's essentially an instrument that they can buy that allows them to bet on the creditworthiness of other banks. And those numbers didn't match the LIBOR numbers, which suggested that LIBOR was too low. Okay, and what this means is, again, this means that the government was encouraging, or at least turning a blind eye while this manipulation was happening. And again, the reason why this is important is because. It's mainly because cities, towns, pension funds, state pension funds, mutual funds, all of these gigantic institutional investors, they have billions and billions of dollars in holdings that are tied to LIBOR. So when LIBOR is lower than it should be, all of these institutions, they earn less. So that means that your town, your city, your pension, your union, is all makes less money when these guys drive the cost of LIBOR down. And for it to come out that the government wanted that to happen, the federal governments, that is, that's incredible.
And we should say that obviously when these this is, you're going to feel this impact when these municipal pensions or funds go down. The city has less money. They project a higher budget imbalance, and they start cutting services.
Right. And they start cutting services, and then that further impacts their when their general bottom line and their balance sheets of these municipalities and towns goes down, then that further impacts their ability to borrow, and it increases their borrowing costs. So it's kind of like a double whammy. It's like they earn less, and then they got to pay more to borrow, and it creates this kind of snowballing effect. When you have layoffs, when people lose benefits, in cities and towns, the town I live in, they had to lay off a whole bunch of cops, they have to lay off firemen. It's not like you can put it entirely at the feet of stuff like this, but this has it has to have a major impact, because if they even did this, if they did a fraction of a percent, we're probably talking about hundreds of billions of dollars that got taken out of the pockets of these towns and municipalities.
Now, if it's just Barclays that was doing this,
Can't be. But go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that in a second. But if it's just Barclays is doing that, is it going to have that huge of an impact on the LIBOR rates?
Well, yeah, no. The thing is, it can't be Barclays because what they do is when they call up every morning, they call 16 banks and they take the four highest numbers and the four lowest numbers and they throw them out. So one bank reporting fake numbers wouldn't have any impact at all. So if the fact that they were doing this suggests that it has to be at least probably 5-6 banks that were involved. And from what I understand, from talking to the lawyers who are leading the civil cases, and there are a couple of big ones, The evidence is going to come out that all 16 banks were complicit in this. So yeah, it had to be.
So are these, like, if you've got these, let's start with the sort of the supposed more rogue reporters, the ones who are theoretically doing this for the benefit of their banks and the specific banks. They would have to know for their lies essentially to have value that they were in, that other people were lying as well.
Right. Right. And we saw this, we see a little bit of the evidence of this in that whole episode with Bob Dimon and Paul Tucker from the, you know, the CEO of Barclays and the Bank of England deputy governor. In their alleged conversation, we hear Dimon saying to Tucker, well, the problem is all the other banks are reporting numbers that don't represent actual, you know, transactions, actual reality. In order for a single bank to have an effect, they would have to know that everybody else was involved. So this it has to be an arrangement, like a cartel-style arrangement, in order for it to work at all.
So the irony here is that it seems like the last holdout is the first one to
right.
to pay a fine, right? I mean, it's sort of like
exactly.
It's like what happened to Serpico.
right,
I'm not sure.
Right.
I can't remember the details of Serpico, but they that's the one guy that they don't trust because he's not on the take, essentially.
Right,
and,
right.
And so, are there investigations about other banks? I mean, are we going to see other banks paying these massive fines?
Yes. Well, the Royal Bank of Scotland has already agreed to pay a £150 million fine. There are investigations in four different countries right now, including Japan, Canada, England, and the United States. All of the usual suspects are kind of under investigation right now, Bank of America, Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase. There are also a couple of major civil suits that are proceeding right now, class action suits where the municipalities are suing. And the expectation is, you know, they have a number of cooperating witnesses already who have worked with authorities and worked with the lawyers for these civil suits. One was from UBS. UBS agreed to cooperate last year, actually, and they already settled. So, yeah, we're going to hear a lot more about this, and we're going to hear about it here and in Canada and in Japan and all over the place.
Who, like, give me the nature of the type of person who would be a cooperating witness. I mean, is it specific people who are inside the banks with specific knowledge as to somebody saying, like, hey, you know, I think our lending rate is going to be this, or you know, in U.S. dollars, 10-year notes, or whatever it is. And but I'm gonna just jack it up a little bit, or drop it down. Is there one person?
Well,
how does that work? I mean, who are these type of whistleblowers essentially?
I think it has to be either traders or the people who report the numbers to LIBOR. I think the Royal Bank of Scotland has already fired a bunch of people who I believe were reporters who were reporting the numbers. So it has to be somebody from that area of the banks, I'm assuming, because this investigation has been going on, I think, for 2 years now, and I think what they did is they kind of dove into the departments in the banks that were responsible for reporting the numbers, and they probably just started at the beginning and flipped somebody in those departments, and that's how this thing is spread. So I'm going to assume it's that. I know that the first reporters came, the first cooperators came from UBS about a year ago, and that's when this thing really started to develop momentum.
Who in the, what agency in the U.S. is involved in these investigations?
I think it's the Department of Justice primarily that's doing this. I don't know if the SEC is involved. I mean, this is it would be an antitrust case if it got that far, if it got to a criminal case. So I'm assuming it's the Department of Justice Antitrust Division that's doing this.
Are we going to hear some executive from Citibank say, well, you know, Bernanke told me to do this. I mean, are we going to...
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a little bit
of... Is that what people
of...
are sort of like waiting for here in this? Is that, you know, I mean, because, I mean, that's the analogy, right, with what happened in Britain?
Yeah, no, if it turns out to be... There was already yesterday all over the blogs, you know, some speculation that an exactly similar situation went on here with the Fed and LIBOR dating back to 2007, I think. But you know, none of that has come out yet. Again, the people who I talk to on Wall Street insist that there's no way that the regulators could not have been aware that there was a problem. I mean, even there were even stories, like you said, in the Wall Street Journal dating back to 2008. There were stories, there were a couple of investigative reports in Germany that came out around that time. So somebody was aware that there was an issue, clearly, and it just wouldn't surprise me, given all that we know about how unaggressively they looked, they went after, you know, other kinds of criminal activity at that time. In the interest of preserving stability, it wouldn't surprise me at all if we ended up finding out that they kind of turned their head on this one just to preserve the appearance of stability.
Yeah, you speculated in your piece. What were Hank Paulson? What was Hank Paulson discussing with Lloyd Blankfein? And Paulson is meeting with the entire board of Goldman Sachs in Moscow.
In Moscow, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there were all these weird communications that went on at this time between the people at the Fed, from the Treasury Department. You know, Paulson met with a bunch of guys at a hedge fund for some reason in the summer of 2008. He meets with Blankfein 24 times. You know, there are communications with Warren Buffett, and then Warren Buffett ends up making this mysterious investment at the Goldman Sachs. I mean, there are the sudden, quickly orchestrated shotgun weddings of, you know, companies like Bank of America and Merrill Lynch, and then, you know, Wells Fargo, Wachovia. It was pretty clear that there were a lot of high-level conversations going on behind the scenes that the public was not privy to, and this is all sort of material, non-public insider information that's going on. But we know, so it's not unrealistic to wonder whether they were also talking about stuff like, you know, the LIBOR rates and things like that.
Right. It's like Paulson walking around in like one of those meetings with all the heads of the families, right? And just with a baseball bat and just saying, you know, LIBOR. It would be great if it was.
Well, right. I mean, again, just to go back, just think about what happened in March of 2008. There was a meeting at the New York Fed where basically all the major banks on Wall Street were invited. It was a sort of a kind of a general get together, but everybody was invited except for Bear Stearns. And you know, nobody knows what was talked about at that meeting, but it was clearly a signal to the rest of them about something. And within a couple of days, Bear Stearns was going out of business because all these other companies were pulling their credit lines from Bear Stearns. And, you know, again, it's just, there's all this weird sort of behind-the-scenes behavior that just makes this kind of scenario with LIBOR manipulation believable, you know. And so we don't really know anything yet, but it's just that it makes you wonder.
Yeah, you really got to wonder, I mean, how does the entire board of Goldman Sachs end up in Moscow at the same time? You know, let's all meet at my suite in my hotel in Moscow. It's just, what a coincidence to run into you guys.
Right. Exactly.
And Moscow is the one place you go. There's apparently they don't have the same type of dogged reporting that we have in this country.
That's right.
So what's the next?
But this all this. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, what's the next shoe to drop? I mean, are we gonna? There was testimony yesterday in England. Apparently, they don't celebrate July 4th like we do. What is the next shoe to drop here?
Well, it's just going to be interesting to see what happens because, to me, it's kind of similar to a situation that I wrote about a month and a half ago, where there was a big scandal that came out about the banks manipulating municipal bond bids, and that was another kind of cartel-style corruption. And all that happened in that case is they basically settled with each one of the big banks that were involved, and they didn't pursue any big criminal cases, and they waited for the public to, you know, not pay attention to it. There was another similar cartel-style corruption case involving price fixing in the foreign exchange markets, the Forex markets, and that, again, they just waited it out. They settled with a few banks, and the public didn't pay any attention to it, and they just kind of blew over. And what I worry about is that that'll happen in this case, is that they'll just, you know, they'll use the Barclays settlement as a template. They'll settle with all the rest of them, and then the public won't demand big changes, which it should, because if, you know, if they get away with this without serious consequences, it calls the entire kind of system into question.
What kind of changes? Well, first off, let me ask you this. Two more questions. One is, do you think this is continuing? I mean, is there any reason to believe that they've stopped doing this in terms of, because we still don't really know what the solvency of these banks are, do we? Or is that basically no longer a question? I mean, we still don't know how much sort of crap these banks are carrying, right? Or they have been able to sort of spread out the losses by becoming that much bigger.
No, we don't know. And it also, we wouldn't, if they were to change, you know, misreport the numbers by a basis point or two every day, there would be no way for us to really know that unless we had a bank examiner sitting on top of that guy every day, which we don't. You know, I mean, this sort of brings into relief the whole problem of a lot of these markets, which is that a lot of them are dependent, very heavily dependent upon self-reporting and self-regulation. And what this episode really underscores is that we cannot trust these guys to self-report accurately. So that, you know, that when you ask what kind of changes you would want to make, that would be kind of one thing that you might want to think about, which is, you know, forcing them to do this officially through some kind of a regulated process.
The invisible hand in the market in this case is actually probably maybe like lifting your wallet, essentially.
right, exactly. And again, this is, people have to remember this is exactly this is the opposite of the invisible hand in the market, right? I mean, this is the invisible anti-market hand, I guess.
Well, I mean, everybody's seems to me that these banks are all operating in their self-interest. And
right.
It's just,
right.
Where's the self-interest, in the rational self-interest in reporting your real numbers if you can make more money or show more stability by not? All right. Well, I guess we'll keep our eyes on this. And I can't imagine anything's going to happen. We're going to see some fines, and maybe they'll just say, like, you know, remember, we'll do this again next time if we have to.
I mean, yeah. I mean, if they find out that it's all 16 of them, I mean, what do you do? I mean, you can't. You can't put them all out of business. You can't nationalize all of them. And I guess you find them more. But
and if it's Hank Paulson telling him to do this, or you know, somebody saying like, you know, let's get with the program here.
Right.
It's just one of those too big to deal with problems, I guess, that we're just
yeah,
it's
we
all
just have
just sort
to kind of live with it. Right. right. So we're glad we know it now, but yeah, okay, good. I mean, I guess that's at least a good thing. Right.
Matt Taibbi, anyway. Rolling Stone, thanks so much for walking us through this.
All right, thanks a lot, Sam.
Appreciate
Talk to you soon.
Bye. All right, folks. We are going to, well, should we talk about this Higgs-Boson discovery, because I don't know what this thing is, and I've read a lot about it. And if you could track my eyes as I read an explanation of what the Higgs-Boson discovery is, you would see that my eyes go across the page, and let's say the page ends here, then my eyes just keep going in a lateral direction, and I just spin around and I look and see if there's a snack around Maybe there's is it time for me to have a drink of whatever it is that I am interested in imbibing at any given point. But basically, this is a it is part of, you know, they have the chemical. It's an elementary part of physics, I guess, that gives other aspects of other elementary parts of physics mass. So let me go to what Tim Dowling at The Guardian has a helpful guide on how to explain Higgs boson to different people. And so I'm going to try it. For people you're trying to impress, I'll just go with this, is the Higgs boson is an elementary scalar particle first posited in 1962. I happen to know that it was posited by Higgs. As a potential byproduct of the mechanism by which a hypothetical ubiquitous quantum field, the so-called Higgs field, gives mass to elementary particles. Well, I practically already said that without even having to read it. I don't know what that means. And this is how you would explain it to a child in the backseat of a car. And this is the one that I got. It's a particle that some scientists have been looking for because they knew without it, the universe would be impossible. Because without it, the other particles in the universe wouldn't have mass. Because they would all continue to travel at the speed of light, just like photons do. And now we'll go to Burger King. That's the way you would talk to that kid in the backseat of the car. But apparently, they've been collecting. They have built this massive, lab, I would call it. I mean, it's this massive structure in between France and Switzerland. It is a 17-mile circular tunnel. Thousands of torpedo-sized magnets, basically, which bend beams of subatomic matter and create trillions of subatomic collisions. Cost $10 billion. It involves 6,000 researchers. And it's underground. They fire all these subatomic, particles, and then collect terabyte after terabyte of data, which I guess they've only gone through like 2% of it, and prove what has already been laid out in mathematics, that there's something else there that creates mass for these kind of particles. Now, this is supposedly, and I've seen some reports with Mark Toma, who was at this conference at CERN, CERN, where a lot of these, I guess, physicists are gathering and are super excited about this. Although some are like, well, we still got to, you know, really see that this is happening. But so far, it looks like it is. And apparently, in this standard model, right, and this is the model that it's like that chart that you have in chemistry, you know, with all the different elements. Well, this is the same version of that, but for physics. They're building blocks. The standard model features two kinds of particles. There are fermions, particles of matter, which take up space. So obviously you can't have them occupy the same space at the same time. And then there are bosons, which are force particles, which can actually take up the same space. Four forces include gravity, electromagnetism, strong nuclear force, and the weak nuclear force. The last one, the weak force, is the most messy and complicated of the forces, and the Higgs boson, or really the Higgs field from which it rises, is the reason why. For other forces, gravity, electromagnetism, strong nuclear force, the force carrying the particles all have precisely zero mass. But I guess the Higgs boson gives the weak ones mass. like I say, I don't know what any of this means. But apparently physicists are pretty excited about it. And some people are saying that when people look back at this time, they'll remember two things. One, the Higgs-Boson discovery. And two, the fact that we didn't do anything about climate change. All this other stuff, just commentary. Why wasn't the Higgs-Boson discovered in America, but instead had to be discovered somewhere beneath the ground in France and Switzerland border, I guess, around that area? Well, in Texas, back in the 1980s, American physicists were developing a particle accelerator, which is another one of these huge, you know, tunnels, I guess, or, I don't know, big pipes. And it was supposed to be three times as powerful as the Hadron Collider, which is where this discovery was made. But Congress cut off the funds. This is Steven Weinberg, a physicist and Nobel laureate, involved in the planning. In the 1980s, plans for a superconducting supercollider, or SSC, which would accelerate protons to 20 TeV, which I don't even know what that means, three times the maximum energy that will be available at the CERN Large Hadron Collider. They designed it for 10 years. A site was selected in Texas. They bought the land. They began construction on the tunnel. And in 1992, House of Representatives canceled the funding for the SSC. It was then restored by a House Senate Conference Committee, but the next year, the same thing happened again. And this time, the House would not go along with the recommendations of the Conference Committee. After an expenditure of almost $2 billion in thousands of man-years, the SSC was dead. And now it will, it's been discovered in Europe and will have all sorts of implications. And just the pursuit of that science has all sorts of implications to science in this country. And, of course, science is all just bunk anyways. We all know that the Earth is only 6,000 years. And it's just God does everything. So. All right, folks, that's our program for today. Maybe I'll have somebody on to describe this thing in a more comprehensive way, but I don't think I would understand it if I had the Higgs sitting right here at this table explaining it to me, frankly. It's just some things I just don't get, but apparently this is very important.
I find it interesting that he apparently wrote decades ago about this particle, and people didn't believe that it existed.
Well, but he wrote about it because he had discovered it through mathematical equations by saying that because we know these certain things, then I guess he goes, it's like Goodwill Hunting. He goes and he writes something on the board.
Apparently Stephen Hawking lost $100 in a bet on whether this thing would be found or not.
There you go.
So
he's not so smart. Yeah, that guy is now 83 years old. He seems pretty psyched, Higgs. And now they've actually, supposedly found it through experiments as opposed to math. Although I'm sure there's some math involved in that.
Dude's going to be the next scientist that, like, kids will learn about along with Einstein and et cetera.
Very possibly. Very possibly. And I don't know. I hope my kid can figure it out because I sure can't. My science probably basically ends just, I don't know. Paint dries after a certain amount of time. Folks, you can help educate me as to science issues by becoming a member of the Majority Report at majority.fm. And if we get enough members and people are really on board with this, I will try and go back to school for 6 to 10 years and see if I can understand this. Highly unlikely, but in the event that you members just want me to continue to analyze politics, I could do that too. But please become a member today at majority.fm. Very easy for you to do. Relatively inexpensive with a lot of the things that you pay for on any given day. So you can also support this show by becoming, by buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop. give us a recommendation on iTunes to get other people listening. It's particularly helpful because we still, a couple of times a quarter, we're still doing Audible podcasts, Audible downloadable books ads. That helps. Not huge, but every little bit helps. This year we'll be able to buy a new printer because of that. It's not nothing. You know how much it sucks to come in and be like, I've got 50 pages of news stories to print out and the printer doesn't work? How much I freak out in that situation? You can also buy your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm/support the show. Tomorrow on the program, I think we're going to have that kid, the former kid, Jonathan Crone, is going to come on. Hopefully he'll give us a movie review. That's what I'm looking for him to do. Apparently he used to watch Break Room Live. That's what he claims. I don't know if that's true or not. Or he was just Googling himself. We'll ask him.
I wonder when he found the Break Room Live episode. Yeah. I wonder if he found it as 13-year-old conservative him or as 17-year-old not conservative him.
Or 15-year-old I'm in transition. Who knows? Well, that's one of the questions we're going to ask him.
I can't wait. I hope it's when he was 13, so I could picture him like cursing you out in front of his computer. This guy knows nothing about conservative.
That would be funny. All right, folks. We'll see you in the better half. You can call the program 646-257-3920. I'm turning on my IM machine right now as we speak. You can IM me at Majority FM on your IM devices. All right, folks. See you in the better half.